Content note, this episode of So Many Books, So Little Time includes manipulation and abuse and rather terrible human value devaluation, as well as describing war crimes, essentially. Not essentially, literally, that's a war crime what they're describing. So there's a war crime. And a few other rather nasty things.
Dark humor.
Dark humor. Yeah, there's some dark humor on our part. There's dark humor that kind of borders on nihilistic slash death slash, yeah, dark coping humor to deal with some fairly heavy topics. So yes.
Hey folks, Dave here.
Andrew.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Please join. Please join us as we continue with Catch 22 by Joseph Heller with Chapter 29, Peckham.
Well, you can sure can't pick him. It's terrible.
It's it reminds me of whenever I'm hungry. I don't even know where the wordplay came from. There's a director, famous director. I think he did a lot of westerns called Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah.
And I for God 10, 15 years, I swear, I get hungry and I'm going, I'm feeling a bit peckish. I'm feeling a bit Sam Peckinpah-ish.
Oh, wow. It's probably from something.
Yeah, I don't know where it's from. Don't know why I keep saying it. I never say it to people. I just say it to myself. Just one of those little mysteries of the brain of Dave.
I'm going to look up something because I swear I know something. Peckham food. Peckham. Peckham. It's giving us a suburb in London. Not helpful. Okay, Peckham. I think there is I swear there's like a dish, like potted meat kind of thing, spread of some sort or like slices.
You think that may be where the term peckish comes from?
No. I think that comes from somewhere else, but I think it comes from, there's a brand that must have used it.
Hmm. Well, the only tinned slash spread meat I know about is Spam.
Is Spam even meat? Sort of.
I wouldn't know. I've never eaten it.
It's extremely salty. Salted.
Well, that sounds like it'd be okay. I do enjoy my salt.
Actually, you'd probably like it in small amounts. It might have been in some dishes if you've ever had any food. On airplanes, sometimes it's used if you've been on Korean Air, yeah. Definitely.
I've never purposely eaten Spam.
Yes.
But it might have been something I've eaten over the years.
Yes. Okay, I'm going to let go of this obsession of trying to figure out where I know the name from, because it is outside of the book, because it is a thing. It could also be because I was thinking of Peckham Station. A station in England.
Well, let's swerve back to the important Peckham in regards to this podcast and this conversation.
Yes.
It's been a few chapters since we got that one about General Dreadle. So, funny enough, I think that one was called General Dreadle, but this one's just called Peckham.
Notorious enough to not get his... Or unless it's talking about his promotions, or he doesn't stay general, or maybe he's demoted or promoted.
Didn't he? I think it was that thing where Peckham only very recently in the timeline became a general, and he was kind of threatening Dreadle's power.
Yes, I think that might have been it. That's why Peckham doesn't get to be general. Also, isn't he the one that's worse?
I'm trying to think if we've actually had encounters with him. I know that PFC Wintergreen doesn't like him, but he doesn't like a lot of people.
Yeah, but PFC Wintergreen also keeps correcting his writing.
Is that the one he's correcting?
I think
thought he
so.
Was correcting Cathcart.
No, well, Cathcart anyway. But specifically, I think he adjusts, he gives Peckham
Oh, feedback. Peckham's the guy that did those like pithy sayings of the day, the moral sayings of the day.
Yes, and that didn't go down well. And the thing is that Dreidel, because Dreidel doesn't have a contentious relationship with Wintergreen, but Peckham does.
Just with Moodus, his son-in-law.
Yes, yes. I think if Moodus wasn't about, Dreidel would actually be able to focus.
Yeah, possibly, although...
He's got his issues. He's old. He needs to go. But
Yeah. He's definitely. I get that feeling. He's like the soldier from a bygone age.
And also, I think someone who because he's from a different era, and he doesn't fit in, and he's feeling frustrated that he didn't get the recognition. He doesn't get his dues in his mind. And because of that, he's developed some sort of issues as well, like in terms of his aggression, in terms of his belligerence, like straight up thing. But he's the one who's actually got more experience.
There is not one healthy person in this entire outfit.
No.
Mentally healthy.
No. And probably not physically healthy either, given the number of different things they've had in the hospitals.
Yeah. There's probably quite a risk of infection. And, you know, even though Milo makes this grand gesture of buying and selling all over Europe and the Middle East and everything, him being a mess officer, I don't know if his food would be that good for anybody.
I don't think so. I think he's probably... Because remember, he sells things. He's a bit dodgy.
I could see him cutting a lot of corners because, you know, it's very profitable to do so. There was that thing where there was a bout of food poisoning before the first Bologna mission. Was that, was he mess officer afterwards?
He was mess officer afterwards. I think he became a mess officer because of the soapening.
The soapening. That's right. Soap Runs. That's the name of the music that appears at the front of the podcast. you know, we are really in the final chapters, even though there's probably many episodes left. But yeah, it's like it really is starting to all form as a whole, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's getting together. Slowly we're getting some sort of coherent vision of what happens. But I think there's still some big gaps.
Well, we talked briefly at the end of last episode. We should go back and, you know, recap. But the big thing last episode was he's missing in action purposely from everything we've seen.
Yeah, we reckon it's all purposeful because it just based on the things that were given as hints throughout that chapter, it felt like, oh, no, this was a planned escape.
Yep.
Yep.
He was basically holding up a giant neon sign for Ysarion, come with me. But Ysarion is too far gone to...
I think Ysarion was too badly affected by then. And also Ysarion wanted to go to Sweden, but couldn't. And so he wanted to go to Switzerland instead. And landlocked targets, I think he wouldn't even think that it's possible to escape. So at least not by sea. And so he gave up and he kind of went...
And I have to wonder if his adversarial relationship with Orr has always been a thing, or it just kind of became a thing once he started declining mentally.
That's a good question.
Because at this point, Orr does get, he's obviously in on a joke of what's going to happen. So that's why he laughs at almost everything, which, sets Ysarion off even more. But it feels like Ysarion that's always been part of their dynamic.
But also, Ysarion is legitimately, also should have been sent home. He is that unwell. He's that traumatized that he should be gone.
But
he isn't.
But earlier also, I think long ago, we talked about when we first got introduced to their dynamic, that it's almost karma because the way... Orr treats Ysarion seems to be the way Ysarion treated everyone else, like Clevenger and folks like that.
And at the same time, the way that Ysarion is, I don't know how much of that is intentional and how much of that is... It's just he's a very literal person.
Yeah, we have talked about that as well, whether, has obnoxious as he is, if that's really not malicious, it's just him... taking things at face value and sticking to his values, like you, what are you talking about? Of course they're trying to kill me. This is ridiculous.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting kind of complex person, but he's also been so severely traumatized and confronted by the reality of death that I don't think any of them are well.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I'd say it. And the way that it's not addressed at all, like the it doesn't get dealt with. It's like, well, yeah, people die. Shrug. Toughen up, buttercup, kind of thing. I'm like, that's going to break people.
Yeah. Even Dobbs, you know, when Eustarion went to Dobbs last chapter and said, okay, let's kill Cathcart because he's put me back on duty. Dobbs had done his mission. So he's just like, I don't want to rock the boat. And Eustarion was like, you fool. But, you know, I can't really blame Dobbs for having, you know, a little bit of hope or optimism that things will work out for him. Mm-hmm. Things will play out the way they're supposed to be.
Yeah. It's yeah.
Yeah. I'm never going to think less of a character for engaging in a bit of optimism.
Mm-hmm. No. Poor guy. I don't see this as ending well. Because we know that the number of flights goes up.
Yep.
To 66 and he's at 60. I'm like, oh, you poor, sweet summer innocent child. No.
Yeah.
Okay, but yes, we are.
It feels like at this point in the timeline, most of the characters are almost resigned to their fate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're, I think a lot of them have given up. A lot of them also are no longer in reality.
Mm.
They've left reality. I think Dobbs is one of them. And, yeah, I would be curious to see what's happening with Dunbar.
Mm. Did he get released alongside Eustarion?
I don't know what happened with Dunbar. I would assume he's out.
Mm.
But also, what happened to Dunbar for him to end up in hospital?
I don't know.
That's a question there as well. It's confusing because we know that Eustarion should have also probably been in hospital longer with his injury.
Mm.
But,
Yeah, it could be, my guess is, like, the previous times Eustarion was in hospital, Dunbar was there a lot of the time, too. So I guess he was putting on an injury.
Mm.
Just like Eustarion's liver problem.
Yeah, although he does have a liver problem. It's just that it's not a bad, bad problem. But yes. So I'm curious to see Peckham. Mm.
Yeah. We'll see how this one goes.
It's a different level of incompetence.
Top brass incompetence.
Mm. Brassy.
A more deadly version.
Yeah.
It really does feel like, you know, well, we've talked about that too. The way the world is supposed to work, the higher you go in the hierarchy, the more responsibility you should have because you're granted with more wealth and power usually as you rise the ranks of whether it's the company or the army. So there's a level of responsibility to go with it because you're being more highly compensated for your role.
But the impact is greater,
But it does feel not only in this book, but just in the general world that when people rise, that they seem to have less responsibility and less idea what they're doing.
In this particular, yes. So they have technically more responsibility, but they're taking less accountability. They're thinking less about it. So the same way that probably why Whitcomb wants to climb up the ranks.
Mm-hmm.
Because
status.
Yep. Oh dear. Okay, so let us commence the joys of Peckham.
Chapter 29, Peckham. There was no word about Ord the next day, and Sergeant Whitcomb, with commendable dispatch and considerable hope, dropped a reminder in his tickler file to send a form letter over Colonel Cathcart's signature to Ord's next of kin when 9 more days had elapsed. There was word from General Peckham's headquarters, though, and Eustarion was drawn to the crowd of officers and enlisted men in shorts and bathing trunks buzzing in grumpy confusion around the bulletin board just outside the orderly room. "What's so different about this Saturday, I want to know," Hungry Joe was demanding vociferously of Chief White Halfoat. "Why won't we have a parade this Sunday when we don't have a parade every Sunday, huh?" Eustarion worked his way through to the front and let out a long, agonized groan when he read the terse announcement there. "Due to circumstances beyond my control, there will be no big parade this Sunday afternoon. Colonel Shyskov." Dobbs was right. They were indeed sending everyone overseas, even Lieutenant Shishkov, who had resisted the move with all the vigor and wisdom at his command, and who reported for duty at General Peckham's office in a mood of grave discontent. General Peckham welcomed Colonel Shishkov with effusive charm and said he was delighted to have him. An additional colonel on his staff meant that he could now begin agitating for 2 additional majors, 4 additional captains, 16 additional lieutenants, and untold quantities of additional enlisted men, typewriters, desks, filing cabinets, automobiles, and other substantial equipment and supplies that would contribute to the prestige of his position and increase his striking power in the war he had declared against General Dreidel. Yeah, it's not for the war effort.
No, it is. His.
His war. He now had 2 full colonels. General Dreidel had only 5, and 4 of those were combat commanders. With almost no intriguing at all, General Peckham had executed a maneuver that would eventually double his strength. And General Dreidel was getting drunk more often. The future looked wonderful, and General Peckham contemplated his bright new colonel enchantedly with an effulgent smile. In all matters of consequence, General P.P. Peckham was, as he always remarked when he was about to criticize the work of some close associate publicly, a realist. He was a handsome, pink-skinned man of 53. His manner was always casual and relaxed, and his uniforms were custom-made. He had silver-gray hair, slightly myopic eyes, and thin, overhanging, sensual lips. He was a perceptive, graceful, sophisticated man who was sensitive to everyone's weaknesses but his own and found everyone absurd but himself. General
Narcissist. Possibly a narcissist. Not that that's overused or anything, but this does smell narcissistic.
General Peckham laid great fastidious stress on small matters of taste and style. He was always augmenting things. Approaching events were never coming, but always upcoming. It was not true that he wrote memorandums praising himself and recommending that his authority be enhanced to include all combat operations. He wrote memoranda. And the prose in the memoranda of other officers was always turgid, stilted, or ambiguous. The errors of others were inevitably deplorable. Regulations were stringent, and his data never was obtained from a reliable source, but always were obtained. General Peckham was frequently constrained. Things were often incumbent upon him, and he frequently acted with greatest reluctance. It never escaped his memory that neither black nor white was a color, and he never used verbal when he meant oral. He could quote glibly from Plato, Nietzsche, Montaigne, Theodore Roosevelt, Marquis de Sade, and Warren G. Harding. One of these things is not like the other. A virgin audience like Colonel Shishkov was grist for General Peckham's mill, a stimulating opportunity to throw open his whole dazzling erudite treasure house of puns, wisecracks, slanders, homilies, anecdotes, proverbs, epigrams, apothegms, bon mots, and other pungent sayings. He beamed urbanely as he began orienting Colonel Shishkov to his new surroundings. "My only fault," he observed with practiced good humor, watching for the effect of his words, "is that I have no faults."
Wow.
Yeah, oh, buddy. He's one of those.
He is incredibly humility. He is incredibly humility. Good English. He is incredibly humble.
I am the most humble person I know. It gives me great reluctance to say that.
Such modesty. Such.
Such modest, so wow.
In the meantime, the fact that I'm just having a moment, is Colonel Shishkov in overseas? Or I think we've jumped into the past.
No, this is the present.
Everyone
was sent over to the war. So remember, he was, because he was so great at parades, he cut out a niche for himself over at the cadet school. But now Lieutenant Shishkov has been sent over to Peckham and made into a colonel to boost Peckham.
Okay, now that makes sense. That makes all sense now. Yes.
And now he's trying to impress Shishkov with his wit as he shows him around.
Yes. Okay, that's it. So yes, he's now, everyone's come overseas, including the former lieutenant who is now a colonel, and much to the, I'm waiting for him to encounter Isarian.
Oh, God. Well, he can't encounter Clevenger.
Well, no, he can't.
Clevenger is no longer with us at this point.
No.
I'll just repeat the last little bit. My only fault, he observed with practiced good humor, watching for the effect of his words, is that I have no faults. Mm. Colonel Shyskov didn't laugh, and General Peckham was stunned. A heavy doubt crushed his enthusiasm. He had just opened with one of his most trusted paradoxes, and he was positively alarmed that not the slightest flicker of acknowledgement had moved across that impervious face, which began to remind him suddenly, in hue and texture, of an unused soap eraser. Perhaps Colonel Shyskov was tired, General Peckham granted to himself charitably. He had come a long way, and everything was unfamiliar. General Peckham's attitude toward all the personnel in his command, officers and enlisted men, was marked by the same easy spirit of tolerance and permissiveness. He mentioned often that if the people who worked for him met him halfway, he would meet them more than halfway, with the result, as he always added with an astute chuckle, that there was never any meeting of the minds at all. General Peckham thought of himself as aesthetic and intellectual. When people disagreed with him, he urged them to be objective.
It's like the well, from my point of view, I am completely logical and rational, and you're being emotional because you disagree with me. It's like, just because it fits into your reality and worldview does not mean it is necessarily rational. Rational is in relation to your actions and the impact they have on the surrounding and your particular impact.
But Rue, I say very sarcastically in case this is misconstrued, I am a very intelligent person, so it just stands to reason that anything I think and say is by definition objective.
I know, I guess. It's really funny. It's like, we're humans, if you don't, like, anyway, so I'm having a moment of reflecting on roles and the concept of the rational human being. And
To be honest, and I am completely aware that it makes me naive on the other side. There are main problems with this, but I tend to take almost the opposite approach, that everything is subjective.
Everything has context, and we need to understand what rational is in a context. Like the fact that he's going, oh, just be objective.
Well, to a point where, like, I understand the argument for it, and I tend to actually agree with the arguments for it, but I still have not been completely convinced that there is such a thing as objective truth.
No, and I think that because truth, there might be the concept of truth. We know that there is truth, but the thing is that truth will depend on information that is available at any given time. So depending on the instruments available, our concept of truth will change.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking in a purely material sense. So in a material world, it's going to look different because it wasn't like a fact. It was a truth that, I don't know, like that the, I'm trying to think of something.
1 + 1 = 2.
Let's not go into maths because there's things in maths that get a bit messy. But in terms of, I'm thinking of physical sciences, like it was a truth, it was an acknowledged truth that that plants, certain plants will only survive at certain temperatures, whatever. And it doesn't account for adaptability and other things. And then we measured and we learned more that this and this is toxic and it's terrible and could never help us. And then we go, oh, wait, let's actually look at it. And we distill and we look at the molecule. Oh, we can actually see what about it is toxic. It's not the, like, for example, certain spiders, when they bite, they can cause serious problems, but it's not the spider that's necessarily venomous. It can be the bacteria that are within the, so little things like that. So we constantly are learning truth or understanding, it shifts and changes.
But I would agree with you that, yes, I think context is imperative. Yeah.
Yes, context is important. It doesn't mean that there aren't certain things that are more probably a closer approximation to truth than others, because there will be. For example, you could sit here and you could guess what the time is, or you can look at where the position of the sun is and estimate based on the season that we're in. Or you can go look at a clock that's synchronized with some sort of universal clock that's measured. But then you can also step back and go, well, time isn't a thing. It's a construct. So
yes, I was about to joke, but what is time?
No, but that's the thing. Depending on what you are using, what tools you're using, how you approach time, all these things, it'll differ. But we know that there is a certain thing that we have set as a measurement.
And I will say one, like, it is very important for just having, for us to be able to live and work together and just exist, that we do have this bedrock of, you know, yeah, time, temperature, yeah, the way money works. Basically, we have an understanding and an acknowledgement and an agreed upon set of what we'll call facts that help
us, or constructs. Help the world. We have common constructs. We need certain common tenets that we agree on in order to be able to construct a world or interaction or framework that work together. And I think that's the thing. We need to find the common points. You can't build things without having certain common points. If you have commonly agreed, and even if the interpretation of those commonly agreed things is slightly different, as long as there's a thread of it that's common, that's together, you can build on that. Whereas with these guys, like, the fact that General Petraeus, everything that he says is right and everything anyone else says is wrong, he's completely objective, but if someone disagrees with him, when people disagree with him, he urges them to be objective, makes the assumption that he's being objective and not affected by the fact that he only sees his own point of view as being the correct one.
Yes. Great, bringing us right back down to continuing the chapter.
Yeah.
And it was indeed an objective Peckham who gazed at Colonel Schadskopf encouragingly and resumed his indoctrination with an attitude of magnanimous forgiveness. You've come to us just in time, Schadskopf. The summer offensive has petered out, thanks to the incompetent leadership with which we supply our troops, and I have a crying need for a tough, experienced, competent officer like you to help produce the memoranda upon which we rely so heavily to let people know how good we are and how much work we're churning out. I hope you are a prolific writer. I don't know anything about writing, Colonel Schadskopf retorted sullenly. Well, don't let that trouble you, General Peckham countered with a careless flick of his wrist. Just pass the work I assign you along to somebody else and trust to luck. We call that delegation of responsibility. just talking about that. Somewhere down near the lowest level of this coordinated organization I run are people who do get the work done when it reaches them, and everything manages to run along smoothly without too much effort on my part. I suppose that's because I am a good executive. Nothing we do in this large department of ours is really very important, and there's never any rush. On the other hand, it is important that we let people know we do a great deal of it. Let me know if you find yourself shorthanded. I've already put in a requisition for 2 majors, 4 captains, and 16 lieutenants to give you a hand. While none of the work we do is very important, it is important that we do a great deal of it. Don't you agree? What about the parades? Colonel Schadskopf broke in. What parades? Inquired General Peckham, with a feeling that his polish just wasn't getting across. Won't I be able to conduct parades every Sunday afternoon? Colonel Schadskopf demanded petulantly. No, of course not. Whatever gave you that idea? But they said I could. Who said you could? The officers who sent me overseas. They told me I'd be able to march the men around in parades all I wanted to. They lied to you. That wasn't fair, sir. I'm sorry, Schadskopf. I'm willing to do everything I can to make you happy here, but parades are out of the question. We don't have enough men in our own organization to make up much of a parade, and the combat units would rise up in open rebellion if we tried to make them march. I'm afraid you'll just have to hold back a while until we get control. Then you can do what you want with the men. What about my wife? Colonel Schadskopf demanded with disgruntled suspicion. I'll still be able to send for her, won't I? Your wife? Why in the world should you want to? A husband and wife should be together. That's out of the question also. But they said I could send for her. They lied to you again. They had no right to lie to me, Colonel Schadskopf protested, his eyes wetting with indignation. Of course they had a right, General Peckham snapped with cold and calculated severity, resolving right then and there to test the mettle of his new colonel under fire. Don't be such an ass, Schadskopf. People have a right to do anything that's not forbidden by law, and there's no law against lying to you. Now, don't ever waste my time with such sentimental platitudes again. Do you hear? Yes, sir, murmured Colonel Shyskov.
Yeah, it's like, as long as there's no law. There are laws. It's called fraud and misleading. Anyway.
Colonel Shyskov wilted pathetically, and General Peckham blessed the fates that had sent him a weakling for a subordinate. A man of spunk would have been unthinkable. Having won, General Peckham relented. He did not enjoy humiliating his men. If your wife was a WAC, I could probably have her transferred here, but that's the most I can do. She has a friend who's a WAC, Colonel Shyskov offered hopefully. I'm afraid that isn't good enough. Have Mrs. Shyskov join the walks if she wants to, and I'll bring her over here. But in the meantime, my dear Colonel, let's get back to our little war, if we may. Here, briefly, is the military situation that confronts us. General Peckham rose and moved toward a rotary of enormous colored maps. Colonel Shyskov blanched. We're not going into combat, are we? He blurted out in horror. Oh, no, of course not, General Peckham assured him indulgently with a companionable laugh. Please give me some credit, won't you? That's why we're still down here in Rome.
Just certainly. Gonna say, we just had a paragraph there where they lied to him.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And but of course not. We're not going to combat. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see.
Certainly, I'd like to be up in Florence, too, where I could keep in closer touch with ex-PFC Wintergreen. But Florence is still a bit too near the actual fighting to suit me. General Peckham lifted a wooden pointer and swept the rubber tip cheerfully across Italy from one coast to the other. These, Shyskov, are the Germans. They're dug into these mountains very solidly in the Gothic line and won't be pushed out until late next spring, although that isn't going to stop those clods we have in charge from trying. That gives us in special services almost 9 months to achieve our objective, and that objective is to capture every bomber group in the U.S. Air Force. After all, said General Peckham with his low, well-modulated chuckle, if dropping bombs on the enemy isn't a special service, I wonder what in the world is.
Don't you agree? So he's trying to get control over this, so he wants them to be under his wing, mm-hmm. but they're currently under General Dreidel.
Yeah.
So he's trying to secure more responsibility, despite the fact that he does less.
U.S. Air Corps, under his wing.
Yeah.
If dropping bombs on the enemy isn't a special service, I wonder what in the world is, don't you agree? Colonel Shyskov gave no indication that he did agree, but General Peckham was already too entranced with his own loquacity to notice. Our position right now is excellent. Reinforcements like yourself keep arriving, and we have more than enough time to plan our entire strategy carefully. Our immediate goal, he said, is right here. And General Peckham swung his pointer south to the island of Pianosa and tapped it significantly upon a large word that had been lettered on there with black grease pencil. The word was Dreidel. Colonel Shyskov, squinting, moved very close to the map, and for the first time since he entered the room, a light of comprehension shed a dim glow over his stolid face. I think I understand, he exclaimed. Yes, I know I understand. Our first job is to capture Dreidel away from the enemy, right? General Peckham laughed benignly. No, Shyskov. Dreidel's on our side, and Dreidel is the enemy. General Dreidel commands 4 bomb groups that we simply must capture in order to continue our offensive. Conquering General Dreidel will give us the aircraft and vital bases we need to carry our operations into other areas. And that battle, by the way, is just about won. General Peckham drifted toward the window, laughing quietly again, and settled back against the sill with his arms folded. Greatly satisfied by his own wit and by his knowledgeable blasé impudence. The skilled choice of words he was exercising was exquisitely titillating. General Peckham liked listening to himself talk, liked most of all listening to himself talk about himself. General Dreidel simply doesn't know how to cope with me, he gloated. I keep invading his jurisdiction with comments and criticisms that are really none of my business, and he doesn't know what to do about it. When he accuses me of seeking to undermine him, I merely answer that my only purpose in calling attention to his errors is to strengthen our war effort by eliminating inefficiency. Then I ask him innocently if he's opposed to improving our war effort. Oh, he grumbles and he bristles and he bellows, but he's really quite helpless. He's simply out of style. He's turning into quite a souse, you know.
What we were saying before, that it's all about him being out of sync.
Hmm.
Mm.
The poor blockhead shouldn't even be a general. He has no tone. No tone at all. Thank God he isn't going to last. General Peckham chuckled with jaunty relish and sailed smoothly along toward a favorite learned allusion. I sometimes think of myself as Fortune Bra, in the play Hamlet by William Shakespeare, who just keeps circling and circling around the action until everything else falls apart. And then he strolls in at the end to pick up all the pieces for himself. Shakespeare is... I don't know anything about plays, Colonel Shyskop broke in bluntly. General Peckham looked at him with amazement. Never before had a reference of his to Shakespeare's hallowed Hamlet been ignored and trampled upon with such rude indifference. He began to wonder with genuine concern just what sort of shithead the Pentagon had foisted on him.
Hilarious.
Like, I thought the book, you know, was using his name because it could get around, you know, just throwing the language out there. But it was saving it.
You saved it for his. This is the mark of a good joke, when you leave it until the very end and then you drive it home.
What do you know about, he asked acidly. Parades, answered Colonel Shyskov eagerly. Will I be able to send out memos about parades? As long as you don't schedule any, General Peckham returned to his chair, still wearing a frown, and as long as they don't interfere with your main assignment of recommending that the authority of special services be expanded to include combat activities. Can I schedule parades and then call them off? General Peckham brightened instantly. Why, that's a wonderful idea. But just send out weekly announcements postponing the parades. Don't even bother to schedule them. That would be infinitely more disconcerting. General Peckham was blossoming spryly with cordiality again. Yes, Shyskov, he said. I think you've really hit on something. After all, what combat commander could possibly quarrel with us for notifying his men that there won't be a parade that coming Sunday? We'd be merely stating a widely known fact. But the implication is beautiful. Yes, positively beautiful. We're implying that we could schedule a parade if we chose to. I'm going to like you, Shyskov. Step in and introduce yourself to Colonel Cargill and tell him what you're up to. I know you two will like each other. Colonel Cargill came storming into General Peckham's office a minute later in a furor of timid resentment. I've been here longer than Shyskop, he complained. Why can't I be the one to call off the parades?
Oh, God. So bad.
Oh, boy. Because Shyskop has experience with parades and you haven't. You can call off USO shows if you want to. In fact, why don't you? Just think of all the places that won't be getting a USO show on any given day. Think of all the places each big-name entertainer won't be visiting. Yes, Cargill, I think you've hit on something. I think you've just thrown open a whole new area of operation for us. Tell Colonel Shyskov I want him to work along under your supervision on this, and send him in to see me when you're through giving him instructions. Colonel Cargill says you told him you want me to work along under his supervision on the USO project, Colonel Shyskov complained. I also like that, work along under his supervision. So it's like, we want you to work alongside him like you're equals, but no, you're under him. It's like two things in the same breath.
Yeah. Aww.
I told him no such thing, answered General Peckham. Confidentially, Shyskov, I'm not too happy with Colonel Cargill. He's bossy and he's slow. I'd like you to keep a close eye on what he's doing and see if you can't get a little more work out of him. He keeps butting in, Colonel Cargill protested. He won't let me get any work done. There's something very funny about Shyskov, General Peckham agreed reflectively. Keep a very close eye on him and see if you can't find out what he's up to. But he's busting into my business, Colonel Shyskov cried. Don't let it worry you, Shyskov, said General Peckham, congratulating himself on how adeptly he had fit Colonel Shyskov into his standard method of operation. Already his two colonels were barely on speaking terms. Colonel Cargill envies you because of the splendid job you're doing on parades. He's afraid I'm going to put you in charge of bomb patterns. Colonel Shyskov was all ears. What are bomb patterns? Bomb patterns, General Peckham repeated, twinkling with self-satisfied good humor. A bomb pattern is a term I dreamed up just several weeks ago. It means nothing, but you'd be surprised at how rapidly it's caught on. Why, I've got all sorts of people convinced I think it's important for the bombs to explode close together and make a neat aerial photograph. But that's right, this came up before. Peckham's stupid idea for bomb patterns because it looks good on camera.
Yep. He is basically Cathcart when he grows up.
Yeah, Cathcart who somehow made his way to general. That's with a frightening prospect.
With no insecurity. Mm. With different as Cathcart with confidence. That would be him.
Like if Cathcart was Arfi.
Yes.
There's one colonel in Pianosa who's hardly concerned anymore with whether he hits the target or not. Let's fly over and have some fun with him today. It will make Colonel Cargill jealous, and I learned from Wintergreen this morning that General Dreidel will be off in Sardinia. It drives General Dreidel insane to find out I've been inspecting one of his installations when he's been off inspecting another. We may even get there in time for the briefing. They'll be bombing a tiny undefended village, reducing the whole community to rubble. I have it from Wintergreen. Wintergreen's an ex-sergeant now, by the way, that the mission is entirely unnecessary. Its only purpose is to delay German reinforcements at a time when we aren't even planning an offensive. But that's the way things go when you elevate mediocre people to positions of authority. He gestured languidly toward his gigantic map of Italy. Why, this tiny mountain village is so insignificant that it isn't even there. They arrived at Colonel Cathcart's group too late to attend the preliminary briefing and hear Major Danby insist, "But it is there, I tell you! It's there! It's there!" "It's where?" Dunbar demanded defiantly, pretending not to see. "It's right there on the map, where this road makes this slight turn. Can't you see this slight turn on your map?" "No, I can't see it." "I can see it," volunteered Havermeyer, and marked the spot on Dunbar's map. "And here's a good picture of the village right on these photographs. I understand the whole thing. The purpose of the mission is to knock the whole village sliding down the side of the mountain and create a roadblock that the Germans will have to clear. Is that right?" "That's right," said Major Danby, mopping his perspiring forehead with his handkerchief. "I'm glad somebody here is beginning to understand. These two armored divisions will be coming down from Austria into Italy along this road. The village is built on such a steep incline that all the rubble from the houses and other buildings you destroy will certainly tumble right down and pile upon the road." "What the hell difference will it make?" Dunbar wanted to know, as the Assyrian watched him excitedly with a mixture of awe and adulation. "It will only take them a couple of days to clear it." Major Danby was trying to avoid an argument. "Well, it apparently makes some difference to headquarters," he answered in a conciliatory tone. "I suppose that's why they ordered the mission." "Have the people in the village been warned?" asked McWatt. Major Danby was dismayed that McWatt, too, was registering opposition. "No, I don't think so." "Haven't we dropped any leaflets telling them that this time we'll be flying over to hit them?" asked the Assyrian. "Can't we even tip them off so they'll get out of the way?"
"Sorry, just a thing. This seems like it's a different spot in the timeline."
"Well, what makes you say that?"
"I'm just trying to figure out why Danby's there."
"Well, he was only sent out on the one briefing."
"Yeah, yeah, it's okay. I was just wondering, where's Major gone off to?" But then again, Danby's he's the one who briefs them on missions, yeah.
And Major wants nothing to do with anything to do with, you know, work.
Anyone. Yeah. Yeah. He's broken now. Yes, okay.
"No, I don't think so." Major Danby was swearing some more and still shifting his eyes about uneasily. "The Germans might find out and choose another road. I'm not sure about any of this. I'm just making assumptions." "They won't even take shelter," Dunbar argued bitterly. "They'll pour out into the streets to wave when they see our planes coming. All the children and dogs and old people. Jesus Christ, why can't we leave them alone?" "Why can't we create the roadblock somewhere else?" asked McWatt. "Why must it be there?" "I don't know," Major Danby answered unhappily. "I don't know. Look, fellows, we've got to have some confidence in the people above us who issue our orders. They know what they're doing." "The hell they do," asked Dunbar. "What's the trouble?" inquired Colonel Korn, moving leisurely across the briefing room with his hands in his pockets and his tan shirt baggy. "Oh, no trouble, Colonel," said Major Danby, trying nervously to cover up. "We're just discussing the mission." "They don't want to bomb the village," Havermeyer snickered, giving Major Danby away. "You prick," Yassarian said to Havermeyer. "You leave Havermeyer alone," Colonel Korn ordered Yassarian curtly. He recognized Yassarian as the drunk who had accosted him roughly at the officers' club one night before the first mission to Bologna, and he swung his displeasure prudently to Dunbar. "Why do you..."
Sorry, see that? He knows Yassarian can take him. It's like, let me focus on Dunbar. Freaking living hell, yes.
"Why don't you want to bomb the village? It's cruel, that's why." "Cruel?" asked Colonel Korn with cold good humor, frightened only momentarily by the inhibited vehemence of Dunbar's hostility. "Would it be any less cruel to let those two German divisions down to fight with our troops? American lives are at stake too, you know. Would you rather see American blood spilled?" "American blood is being spilled. but those people are living up there in peace. Why can't we leave them the hell alone? Yes, it's easy for you to talk, Colonel Korn jeered. You're safe here in Pianosa. It won't make any difference to you when these German reinforcements arrive, will it? Dunbar turned crimson with embarrassment and replied in a voice that was suddenly defensive. Why can't we create the roadblock somewhere else? Couldn't we bomb the slope of a mountain or the road itself? Would you rather go back to Bologna? The question, asked quietly, rang out like a shot and created a silence in the room that was awkward and menacing. Yessarian prayed intensely, with shame, that Dunbar would keep his mouth shut. Dunbar dropped his gaze, and Colonel Korn knew he had won. No, I thought not, he continued with undisguised scorn. You know, Colonel Cathcart and I have to go to a lot of trouble to get you a milk run like this. If you'd sooner fly missions to Bologna, Spezia, and Ferrara, we can get those targets with no trouble at all. His eyes gleamed dangerously behind his rimless glasses, and his mighty jowls were square and hard. Just let me know. I would, responded Havermeyer eagerly with another boastful snicker. I like to fly into Bologna straight and level with my head in the bombsight and listen to all that flak pumping away all around me. I get a big kick out of the way the men come charging over to me after the mission and call me dirty names. Even the enlisted men get sore enough to curse me and want to take socks at me. Colonel Korn chucked Havermeyer under the chin jovially, ignoring him, and then addressed himself to Dunbar and the Assyrian in a dry monotone. You've got my sacred word for it. Nobody is more distressed about those lousy b****s up in the hills than Colonel Cathcart and myself. Marcel Le Guerre. Try to remember that we didn't start the war and Italy did, that we weren't the aggressors and Italy was, and that we couldn't possibly inflict as much cruelty on the Italians, Germans, Russians, and Chinese as they're already inflicting on themselves. Colonel Korn gave Major Danby's shoulder a friendly squeeze without changing his unfriendly expression. Carry on with the briefing, Danby, and make sure they understand the importance of a tight bomb pattern. Oh no, Colonel, Major Danby blurted out, blinking upward. Not for this target. I've told them to space their bombs 60 feet apart so that we'll have a roadblock the full length of the village instead of in just one spot. It will be a much more effective roadblock with a loose bomb pattern. We don't care about the roadblock, Colonel Korn informed him. Colonel Cathcart wants to come out of this mission with a good, clean aerial photograph he won't be ashamed to send through channels. Don't forget that General Peckham will be here for the full briefing, and you know how he feels about bomb patterns. Incidentally, Major, you better hurry up with these details and clear out before he gets here. General Peckham can't stand you. Oh no, Colonel, Major Danby corrected obligingly. It's General Dreidel who can't stand me. General Peckham can't stand you either. In fact, no one can stand you. Finish what you're doing, Danby, and disappear. I'll conduct the briefing. Poor Danby. Where's Major Danby? Colonel Cathcart inquired after he had driven up for the full briefing with General Peckham and Colonel Schatzkopf. He asked permission to leave as soon as he saw you driving up, answered Colonel Korn. He's afraid General Peckham doesn't like him. I was going to conduct the briefing anyway. I do a much better job. Splendid, said Colonel Cathcart. No, Colonel Cathcart countermanded himself an instant later when he remembered how good a job Colonel Korn had done before General Dreidel at the first Avignon briefing. I'll do it myself. Colonel Cathcart braced himself with the knowledge that he was one of General Peckham's favorites and took charge of the meeting, snapping his words out crisply to the attentive audience of subordinate officers with the bluff and dispassionate toughness he had picked up from General Dreidel. He knew he cut a fine figure there on the platform with his open shirt collar, his cigarette holder, and his close-cropped, gray-tipped, curly black hair. He breezed along beautifully, even emulating certain characteristic mispronunciations of General Dreidel's, and he was not the least bit intimidated by General Peckham's new colonel until he suddenly recalled that General Peckham detested General Dreidel. Then his voice...
Aw, silly man.
Then his voice cracked, and all confidence left him. He stumbled ahead through instinct in burning humiliation. He was suddenly in terror of Colonel Schatzkopf. Another colonel in the area meant another rival, another enemy, another person who hated him. And this one was tough. A horrifying thought occurred to Colonel Cathcart. Suppose Colonel Schatzkopf had already bribed all the men in the room to begin moaning as they had done at the first Avignon mission. How could he silence them? What a terrible black eye that would be. Colonel Cathcart was seized with such fright that he almost beckoned to Colonel Korn. Somehow, he held himself together and synchronized the watches. When he had done that, he knew he had won, for he could end now at any time. He had come through in a crisis. He wanted to laugh in Colonel Schwarzkopf's face with triumph and spite. He had proved himself brilliantly under pressure, and he concluded the briefing with an inspiring peroration that every instinct told him was a masterful exhibition of eloquent tact and subtlety.
He needs to stop trusting his instincts. Yes.
Yes, his instincts fail him.
All the time.
Now, men, he exhorted, we have with us today a very distinguished guest, General Peckham from Special Services, the man who gives us all our softball bats, comic books, and USO shows. I want to dedicate this mission to him. Going out there and bomb, for me, for your country, for God, and for that great American General P.P. Peckham. And let's see you put all those bombs on a dime.
Wow.
If I had to sum up that chapter in one word, I think I'd use the word dysfunction.
Yeah. Dysfunction is one word. I would also say, like, systematic incompetence.
That's nice.
It's deliberately, if part of it is because Peckham wants he wants to look good, so he makes everyone around him constantly fighting within themselves.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think this is just an inference from that whole exchange between Cargill and Schwarzkopf. I've heard that before, that a lot of time people in power who are insecure about their position will have their underlings fight for their approval, because then no one can amass the power to kind of rise to their level.
But also, wasn't the situation that Peckham, although Dreidel is technically in charge of everything?
Well, it seems now, I kind of got it at the end. It seems, yeah, Peckham is in charge of special services, which is like the USO shows and rations and all the things the men do for leisure, while General Dreidel is in charge of all the actual combat missions. But over time, Peckham has slowly been pulling away combat responsibility.
Yeah, he's been trying to undermine and get in control. And because he's been doing that, he's causing disruption and issues. Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I'm curious about I want to go back to the beginning of that. Because Dreidel isn't here right now. Yeah. He's gone to Sardinia.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out where the mission came from to bomb the village.
Wasn't it Peckham himself? Because there was the thing about they need to do a mission to create a roadblock, but they don't even worry about German reinforcements. So the whole thing's for show.
Yeah, I'm trying
to find. And the thing that disgusted me, of course, is, and Dunbar and Yossarian were right there, the idea that why are we killing all these innocent people just for a mission that doesn't matter?
There's this thing, a bomb pattern is a term I came up with. I've got all sorts of people convinced it's important for bombs to explode together to make a neat aerial photograph. So he's convinced Cathcart. There's a colonel in Pianosa who's hardly concerned anymore whether that's Cathcart. So he uses Cathcart to feel amused.
Mm.
It'll make them jealous. I've heard from Wintergreen, Dreidel's off. It drives him. He doesn't like him around. They'll be bombing a tiny undefended village, reducing the whole community to rubble. I have it from Wintergreen. Wintergreen's an ex-sergeant that the mission is entirely unnecessary.
Mm.
It's only to delay reinforcements when we're not even planning an offensive. So someone else in charge. Yeah. This is the way things go when you elevate mediocre people to positions of authority. So he feels that anyone else who's in charge is actually incompetent, and that's why he's going out there deliberately to cause more and more headaches.
And that thing he told Schwarzkopf, we don't actually do a lot of work here, but it's important to make it look like we're doing a lot of work.
Yeah, which is the whole canceling parades and canceling USO tours and stuff.
Also, the aerial bomb photographs, and even this mission sounds like that's part of that offensive as well.
I think that might be not from him. He's not in charge of the bombing and stuff.
No, but the bomb clusters was his idea.
Yes, the bomb clusters, yes, but not the actual mission. And he's getting the information from Wintergreen, who's on his little...
Right.
So Wintergreen doesn't like him.
At this point, does Wintergreen like anyone?
I don't think so. I seriously doubt it.
Oh, he's an ex-sergeant now.
Yeah. I mean, he's ex all sorts of stuff. He keeps jumping up and down, who knows. But someone's in charge that's made these decisions, obviously.
And you know, the fact that he wanted to get there while Dreidel would be off, it makes me wonder if this mission is Dreidel's.
I don't think it's Dreidel's mission. Again, I think Dreidel, there's the people that are in charge on top of him, which is why Dreidel gets frustrated as well. Because they keep making decisions that don't actually necessarily make sense according to him. And he's actually on the ground and he has combat experience, so he's not wrong. But sometimes he also, which is probably why he gets annoyed at Danby. Because, yeah, he'd be getting annoyed because he's seeing some of these things as being pointless as well. So it's kind of, but he's also kind of given up. So it's a bit of a mess. And dealing with Peckham probably would drive the most calm person up the wall.
Yeah.
Not that he is a calm person, but you know.
Oh, he likes to give the air of being affable.
Well, no. Yeah, no. Peckham is nonsense. Corn.
Peckham is nonsense. That's a quote by Rue.
Yeah, thank you. And Corn, on the other hand, is a cruel, ambitious little. He's also gone from lieutenant colonel to colonel. Interesting that.
Because when Cathcart fell apart in the middle of that speech, it was because he finally recognized that Scheisskopf was a colonel and is like, oh crap, another rival. So maybe, the promotion of Korn has really set Cathcart's insecurity ablaze.
Well, it's already ablaze. But yes, it would be getting worse.
Well, he's always simmering at like a 95, but this might have put it up to like a 99.
Yeah, I think Dunbar's also not going to be. Ysarion seems to just, like, he doesn't want to do it, but he's also, I don't want to go to, I can't go back to Bologna. I can't go back to.
Yeah, he's not raising his stink this time. He's just hoping that he's like Dunbar. Maybe he can't do it anymore. He doesn't have it in him to be Dunbar anymore.
Well, I think he doesn't want to do it, but at the same time, if it's him or if it's going back to, because Corn just threatened them.
No, but what I mean is, like, in previous, like, the whole, there was that allusion to the moaning briefing, which was hilarious. But in previous briefings, we've seen Ysarion speak his mind at a moment's notice. But this far along the timeline, he might not have the wherewithal to actually be able to do that anymore.
I don't think he can, but also it's fear. He is so afraid of going back to Bologna or the other location, Spitzi, or other places that were really...
Yeah.
They were not milk runs. They were deceptive milk runs that were not milk runs.
And the twisted benevolence of Korn going, look, I twisted strength to get you this easy mission where you're bombing a bunch of civilians. Why are you complaining to me? Yeah, that really, it's
notice
disgusting.
Notice right at the beginning of the chapter... Whitcomb is using Cathcart's signature.
Yep.
So it's not even going to be when this hits the fan, because it will. There's no way it won't. When it hits the fan, it's Cathcart's head.
Yep. Hoist by his own petard, as the saying goes.
Much petarding, much hoisting. Yes, yes, yes. Mistake. Oh, well. Corn did suggest to him that it was a great idea, and that should have been a massive warning.
I mean, I have a little sympathy for when his fall happens, but the majority of my head is like, nah, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
For me, it's because when your value and your progress is based on the suffering and the control and the abuse of others... And you treat others as expendable as long as you advance. You know. Have you heard the expression, I hope you have the day you deserve?
No, but that's pretty nice.
It's a good one. I hope you have the day. I hope you have the life you deserve. And that could be good, or it could be really, I don't think much of you, and therefore I hope you have. Yeah. But I'm like, I like the idea of, if you meant it sincerely... I hope you have the day you deserve. I hope you have a life that is, how it is appropriate for what you are, like who you are.
It actually has the same energy with how I used to say have a nice day when I worked in customer service. If they were a pleasant person, I meant it completely on its face value. You seem nice and polite, so I hope you have a good day. If they were awful, it would be, the subtext would be, I hope you have a better day so you're not as much of a miserable bastard.
Yeah. I think I like that expression, but I also kind of, I don't really want to use it ever. But it is pretty, like, it's an interesting one. And that's the vibe I get from, like, towards Cathcart and all of them, really.
Yeah, the deck's been he's been stacking his own deck against them for a while, and that this metaphor, the House of Cards is going to come crashing down.
And especially because he'll be a good linchpin to bring down Dreadle, so I would say Peckham would pull it.
Yeah, it almost seems like the climax of this book might be the entire restructuring of the officers of this outfit.
I think it's going to be a bit of that. That's what it feels like. It's a power play. It's constant power plays.
Because we're almost three quarters in the book, and we're talking about power plays, not the war. General Peckham's war, not the war of the U.S. versus Germany.
the war that's happening in the background, and Korn's justifications, like, well, they brought this on themselves.
Yeah, because I'm sure a bunch of civilians living in the mountains had a lot to do with how the leaders of the country decided to ally themselves.
Yeah, it's the same. I mean, anyway, it's all.
And even the worst part, as the Assyrian pointed out, these are not people who are going to seek shelter. They're going to see planes, and they're all going to come out and wave.
Yeah.
It's like, can we warn them? And it's like, no, they'll risk the our own troops or risk Germany, you know.
But American lies and American blood. Like, guys, you came here.
Yep.
You decided to come here and, never mind.
and also, like, I assume the guise of what they are doing in Italy is, you know, that line we've heard many times. They're there to liberate the Italian people.
Yeah. Freedom.
Liberate them from their lives, apparently.
Liberate them from their lives. And well, I mean, it is the ultimate freedom. That is very dark.
Mm-hmm.
Very dark. I will have to warn people.
Sweet release.
No, it's terrible. Okay, I'm giving a warning. That was bad. Oh, dear. But yeah, it's going to be interesting. And next, next chapter is about Dunbar, so...
I don't see
him as going well. I don't think this is going to go well for him.
Well, I don't think we've had a Dunbar chapter. Like, I'm thinking back, I don't know much about him. So that'll be interesting.
We know some things about him, but we don't know... we don't know enough, I think. I think he's a person who, much like he has humor, jovial, has some values. You know.
Him and the Assyrian really seem like two peas in a pod. They're very similar people.
I think so. Possibly. But he could also be a little bit of a contrarian. He gives a bit of a contrarian vibe.
Mm.
But also, just because it's fun. He's like, if Arfi actually had redeeming features and wasn't all about himself and... Okay, basically not Arfi, so that doesn't work, but...
Or like how you thought Yassarian was just after that first chapter when he was signing Washington Irving's name in the hospital.
Yeah,
you thought he was just the guy who was trying to amuse himself.
I think he's more the poopster. He's more the shoopster or...
I already said the word. It was in the chapter.
Yeah, it was. I said the shitster. Yes.
don't be a shy scout through
a poop proliferator I want a word. A poop propeller. Oh no. That's gonna be another one.
Poop pot luck?
No, because instead of shit stirrer, it becomes a poop propeller.
Meow.
And it is related to the Air Force,
it goes everywhere.
Oh, it's like a little Roomba that doesn't have AI.
Oh, I've seen those videos that they try and clean the mess the dogs left on the carpet. Oh, no.
They've introduced AI now for some of them to recognize. No, wait, this is poo. Do not move it. Dear.
Well, please. I hope you folks have enjoyed this episode. I thought it was a good read and we had some good discussion. So until next time, when we learn a bit more about Dunbar and how he's coping or not coping.
I don't think he's coping.
The music at the top of the podcast is Soap Runs. I mentioned that at the top of the podcast, but I did not say who it's by. It is by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Harry Gregson-Williams. And it's from the adaptation of Catch-22 from 2019. The music at the end of the podcast is I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
And you can find me at Rue McMurd on the Twitter, and our podcast at SMBSLT Podcast, both on Twitter, on Facebook, and if you add @gmail.com, our email. We hope you feel free to send a line, to tag us in a post that might be related to the topics that we've raised. Anything, it's great. If you can, drop feedback regarding our post. If you are able to, or if you use Apple, if you leave a review regarding our podcast, that'd be great.
Any platform that allows rating or review, we would appreciate it.
Very much so.
I hear it pushes us out to more people.
Yeah.
So that would be great. You know, onwards and upwards.
Yes. And also let us know if you've been reading books with your friends or discussing topics or anything that's been uplifting, that like good news stuff.
Or
like,
just what you're reading. I always find it fascinating what people are reading.
Tell us a book that you're reading. We're happy to hear about it. Like, that'd be awesome. Anyway.
I'm in the middle of a very famous one at the moment, and I've got some feelings on it, but maybe I'll wait till I'm finished with the book to bring it up on the podcast.
Good idea.
But until then, I'm Dave. That's been Rue. Keep safe. Enjoy your reading. We'll see you next time.